All lines are now bridged.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Information Blocking Task Force meeting. Today we're going to continue on with our discussion on recommendations for the rule, and I will officially begin the call by taking roll. Andrew Trescott.
Present.
Michael Adcock.
Present.
Stephen Lane.
Good morning.
Good morning. Sherilyn Turney. Cheryl Turney.
Good morning.
Good morning. Denise Webb.
Present.
Hello. Aaron Mary.
He's running 10 minutes late.
That's okay, he's 10 minutes. Okay. Arian Malik. Not here. Valerie Gray.
Here.
Anil Jain.
Here.
Hello. Cynthia Fisher. John Kansky.
Here.
Lauren Thompson. Denny Malcolm.
I'm here.
Okay, great. So we'll turn it over to your chairs.
Thanks, Sandra. Morning, everybody. Thank you very much for joining us. Guys on the West Coast, especially thank you, given that you flew back overnight and got there very, very late and then joined the call very, very early. I'll just say that.
Yeah.
Anyway, thanks ever so much. We've got two kind of focuses today to go through. One is the promise that your chair made yesterday, just to touch upon the intellectual property and screenshots provisions inside 17403 communications. And the second is to go through the fees and to use the vernacular recommendations as drafted out of work group two. Can you let me know as soon as Arian has joined? Because Arian will be driving that piece of the conversation.
Okay.
So if we move straight to 17403, let's just look upon that. Actually, is this full task force? This is, isn't it? This is full task force.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so yesterday this did cause some degree of discussion in HITAC. I'll open it to the group. To what extent do we think that actually we need to go back and modify some of the language, maybe something in the preamble? Fair use as a definition caused discourse? Arian Malik has entered the room.
Oh, so sorry.
That's okay, though. So, the discussion around fair use, I'll be interested to have Mark and Mike's feedback on that without me giving them curveballs for the table. So, guys, what do you think? You're all in the room. You heard the comments.
Thank you much. Yeah. Well, I mean, I try to understand it from the point of view of someone who might want to do usability research or looking at effectiveness of the technology, as well as the vendor who needs to protect their intellectual property. And, you know, if you look, and I think was it Mark who mentioned the different reasons why there should not be any blocking of the screenshots. That list made sense. What I think vendors would be concerned about is when someone uses the screenshots for some alternative purpose. So I think revisiting those reasons and making sure that we're not missing any, and then making sure that we account for what I think it was Raj was trying to get at, or maybe it was somebody else. But I didn't quite understand what the issue was with the current language.
Also, look in the media coverage and tell me what the issue was. I think there was concern that fair use could be used by a vendor who was trying to be unreasonable. I think that was Raj's concern.
I think the other concern was that if somebody put it to fair use, that they would somehow be responsible for everyone's secondary use of that and assuring that was going to be fair, which
that was the other,
at that, all I, possible.
Yeah, that was the point I was going to get to. I think that was quite valid. We all understand that. We didn't want to put the burden over anybody who was doing the initial fair use, so all downstream fair use they had to police.
That seems like a very, I'm not saying it's a silly argument, but it just seems like we already have examples of that. If I write an article and it gets published in the journal, and someone wants to use that article, they have to go back and look at the original copyright. So
it was the way that our drafting, we actually drafted and said, any actor disclosing the screenshots are responsible for ensuring that each use is being put to fair use.
They need to, if they hand it to somebody, they should take the responsibility to tell them, you know,
that's what
you cannot just freely disclose this information.
So maybe the way to put that is that an actor, that you can't use the word actor, is that somebody, something, let's use the example of a screenshot for safety critical, you know, evaluation. That merely by using it in that capacity, any subsequent use is not deemed fair use. It has to be tested fair use. And it doesn't by that nature become public domain or non-copyrighted. So, I mean, this is all, I think this is all pretty standard under fair use law, that fair use is fair use is fair use. And I think all we're saying is that merely by using a screenshot or other copyrighted material in the context of the permitted activities, we're not thereby saying that it escapes the usual provisions of copyright law. Right.
Yes. Yeah. I think there's two sides. One is the side I think we all agree on, that you're not responsible for policing downstream use. You're responsible for communicating the
right.
So we're kind of updating.
That's what I'm saying. That's already contemplated in intellectual property law and fair use.
Absolutely is.
Is that if I use something and it is not fair use, that's an IP.
I think it was more of an inadvertent overreading of our drafting.
That's right.
That was just so kind of updated this.
I'm just arguing for we don't need that in the drafting because it's
okay.
We should make it, if we feel we need to make it clear, we should make it clear that you're using something subject to.
You should put it in the preamble.
Okay.
Because if you want to explain that explanation shouldn't go in the regulatory.
So kind of do that. Just insert the term fair use and then put the rest in preamble.
And I know that we have some issue with it. Mike, who brought up us introducing that term in the regulatory text, but the thing is, it's already in the regulatory text, which I tried to point out that it's already in sub 1 there. It's in the actual regulatory text.
That would be a
fair use of copyright work. They use that word fair use, that term.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure why you
have
concerns or took issue with that.
Well, Mark, do you
want to
speak to that?
Sorry, so the question is, I guess I don't remember. You're saying Mike said that fair use was not in regulatory text? Is that the comment?
I believe it was Mike who brought up a point that the committee, or excuse me, the task force was introducing the term fair use in the regulatory text, and it's not in the regulatory text, but it is. It's in sub 1 above.
Yeah. So I guess I don't remember. I mean, it's possible. I mean, I trust that he said something like that. My guess is if he said that, he probably was just talking about specifically in the context of 2. And I think what he probably meant is that we don't define fair use in our definition because it's an established term in IP. Might have been what he meant. I think it just comes down to, as far as the addition in 2, I think there's a good conversation about adding in a preamble. It comes down to whether you think, in addition to removing in reg text the language you had before, does having that fair use and to add value to the, to, you know, given the fact that there's this understanding in IP law.
It absolutely does.
If you don't say that, and you're saying that a health IT developer does not prohibit communication,
it just makes it crystal clear.
It makes it clear, crystal clear, yeah.
Okay, great. No, I'm not taking one side or the other. Just want to just pose the question.
Sorry, this is Ken. I'm on. Can you hear me?
Yep.
I can.
Yeah, I think even if it's in for a common use, I think it should be referenced, right? Just saying fair use, you know, reference, see this copyright law, just so that, you know, the terms, maybe folks will commonly understand it, but I think that certainly helps, right? If you say this is exactly what we mean by fair use. And also, I think it's still this notion of, it's when I reread the regulatory text, it seemed like screenshots were called out as separate from all the other kinds of communications about, you know, about health IT, about the other parts. It says, unless it's one of these five or six things, then, you know, it basically this doesn't cover it. You, health IT developers can put whatever IP restrictions they want, was sort of what I read. But then the screenshots part, it seems to take the opposite approach where it says it's presumed to be shareable except in these circumstances or, you know, for these restrictions. I think getting some clarity there is would be good because in my assumption, it's actually the screenshots are a huge part of what you'd want to potentially communicate. So that's a little bit puzzling where the language says, as a default, you know, you can't share except for just these things. And then on the screenshot part, it seems to say, as a default, you can share. And if, in fact, it is that as a default, you can share screenshots, I understand putting in these restrictions. But that seemed like a puzzling way to put in regulatory text.
And can I mean, just throw out a question to the group. When I was listening to the discussion, and I heard several times that one of the instances where you could not share the screenshot is if there was PHI in it.
So that
one kind of caught my attention because you have provider X who's talking to provider Y. They're in two different health systems, and they're not necessarily printing the screenshot. Maybe they're sitting there with them, and they're showing them the screenshot. Is showing the screenshot the same as sharing the screenshot?
No. There's a difference here. One is around the effectively sharing a patient record,
yeah.
And the only means they have available to me is by taking a screenshot because for some reason I can't do anything else, and
yeah.
I will send that to you, whether it's hard copy, whether it's an email, whatever. That happens. You don't like it, none of us like it, but it happens. And
that's prohibited.
We don't want it to be. I think what was being referred to was when a screenshot is shared, it's intended for some kind of fair use of research study, whatever, and it has PHI inside it.
Oh.
That's what's prohibited, because then that's a breach.
Okay, well, I hope that's crystal clear, because...
Stephen Lane has his hand up.
Oh,
you know.
Stephen
Lane has...
Go ahead.
Mr. Lane, go ahead. We haven't got the presenter view this end, so...
Oh, okay. No problem.
Just share.
I wanted to echo what Ken said, which is I think it's really important that we make reference to definitions of these terms, because these are critical questions on the part of end users, and I think on the part of HIT vendors. And I think that it leads to some significant consternation between those parties because people want to and feel a need to share screenshots, you know, amongst themselves, across customers, across communities. So I do not think we can assume a definition of a term like fair use. And I think the more specific we can be, the better.
Fair use is a defined term elsewhere in the legal canon. We shall.
And it perhaps we should capitalize it also in that case.
Okay.
This is Mark. Just wanted to say I can't pull up on my screen right now the regulation because I'm sharing. But I do believe in preamble. I know what Arian thinking is, you know, it's preamble, but we do cite where the definition of fair use comes from, and we have that. But if you all think that's not clear enough, you could make a recommendation that the definition or the reference be made in the definition section or some recommendation like that. But I do believe it is in preamble.
Can I ask a question real quick? This is Aaron, real quick. I was thinking about it. Do screenshots also include the ability for, say, CIOs or whatnot to be able to share contracts and contractual language with each other? Because one of the things that we have been impeded about is looking at, you know, what terms and conditions, things like that, and trying to figure out what the market looks like and what allows us to be flexible. And a lot of times you're forbidden to even share that, just contractual language.
No,
so if I took a screenshot of my contract, is that
not unusual practice? So this happens. Sharing of contracts happens. People discuss contractual terms. They're not supposed to, and it's not a usual practice.
Okay, I just want to ask a question.
Yeah.
I think that's going to come up.
I think what we're trying to facilitate here with the screen sharing or the sharing of screens, communicating screens, is if someone believes that there is a usability issue that's causing the patient harm, they should be able to do that without the vendor coming after them.
I think we should narrowly target the information blocking provisions to the things that people have significantly expressed concern about, which is that some people interpret the confidentiality clauses of contracts to prevent the use of screenshots for demonstrating safety issues.
Education,
usability issues, and rights.
Things related to the treatment of the patient.
Sure. Yeah.
Do we actually want to say and call that out? The intellectual property considerations come second place to providing patient care. That's what seems to be the sentiment I'm getting. And the preamble doesn't discuss that particularly. I don't know whether that wasn't. I mean, it's got like contortious faces.
I am making contortious faces. I don't know what I think about it. I mean, I understand it's usual practice. I understand it's a workaround for the lack of interoperability of systems.
The people who do it will purport it's the only way they can.
I understand, right. It's a workaround for the lack of interoperability of systems. Do you want to codify it in practice? I don't know. Do you want to create an explicit safe lane for it? It is a practice that is frequently used to communicate information for the context of treatment.
Arian, would you just simply say that screenshot used for intended purposes prohibited for development, you know, developers using, you know, for purpose of developing software, competitive software, and just let it be with respect to, it is a workaround, it's how people may practice and be able to communicate until the systems are, we have interoperability, then just address.
I'm advocating staying silent on it. It's a practice that's used. I'm not sure we want to say
sometimes
that it's either, I'm not sure that we're going to say it's either legal or illegal.
Yeah.
Well,
you know, I think if you don't have interoperability, it's the only way you can communicate regarding the patient.
Yeah,
and then if people get fearful that they are doing a copyright violation because they can't print over the pipes, you know, they don't have it over the pipes together.
Okay. As a patient, I have gotten all kinds of screenshots because that's the only reasonable way that somebody had to communicate some information to me.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Are you saying that we should explicitly say that that's allowed or stay silent on it and let people
do
what
they're
doing?
I think you're saying should we just say this is permitted use.
I would allow it for permitted use to the patient except not for competitive, you know, not to have a copyright protection for competitive practice.
Right. I guess my take on it would be I think it's going to happen, and it's going to happen in rural communities where they're using some EMR and they're not have an alternative. I get that. And it happens in big cities. But if we say something about it, we're sort of implicitly saying that that's something that we think that this committee feels or this task force feels is appropriate action as opposed to implementing some other mechanism to exchange. And so if we stay silent on it, it's not a harm to stay silent on it because still be, you could argue that it's fair use.
Given the discussion that went on yesterday, it feels like there is sufficient sentiment to just stay quiet and say nothing is a bit of a cop out.
Well, then why don't we put some language in there saying that we should explicitly allow continued use?
And that's what I'm thinking. So this particular section is around permitted prohibitions and restrictions.
I understand that, but I think sometimes there are a lot of things that happen with information sharing that are going to happen. And I think if we explicitly put it in here, then there's other forms of information sharing.
And that's endorsing it. Yeah.
I'll defer to the consensus of the group, but staying silent doesn't mean that it's a cop out. It means that, you know, I think the most important thing to do is to think about why screens are shared. What are the appropriate reasons? What are the reasons that are going to happen because there's no alternative? And what are the reasons that are absolutely illegal and forbidden? It should be illegal and forbidden. For example, I wouldn't want a screenshot of, I'll make up one of our solutions, Watson Oncology, so that a consulting group can train themselves up and then go sell services on it, or a competitor can build it on it. That's pretty straightforward. But we also shouldn't be advocating for two providers who find it easier to do screen dumps and share those instead of flipping a few switches and sharing information the other way around. So I'll stop.
No, these are all good points. And I don't want to push too far.
This is kind of just that. Sorry, if I could ask clarification, is it the fact that this copyright part is in fact a, you know, you can do it unless we say here that you can't, or is it a subset of the earlier part that says that's basically the parts that aren't like the five or six specifically, you know, exempted communications? As in, is it a further restriction starting from a limited set, or is it a, you know, starting from everything's allowed except in these cases? Because I think that is a really important point, right? Because otherwise, all this is still in the context of, like, I'm reporting something for safety reasons, you know, that kind of thing. Usability, I don't think, is even in there in terms of, you know, reporting on usability unless it's safety.
Ken, it's the second one. It would still be bound by the purposes, but it's not restricted to the unqualified protections.
Correct.
Here, I can just... It says here, we consider screen displays an essential component of health IT performance and usability, and their reproduction may be necessary in order for a health IT user or other health IT stakeholder to properly make communications about the subject matters enumerated in 170.403A1. Which says, a health IT developer may not prohibit or restrict the communication regarding the usability of its health IT, the interoperability of its health IT, the security of its health IT, relevant information regarding user experiences.
And if you couple that with what Mark is saying right now, the developer is not permitted to prohibit or restrict communications under the guise of copyright protection or under the guise of confidentiality or NDA, when the communication in question makes a use of the copyright material in a way that will qualify as a fair use. It feels like that actually covers it. The question is whether we think the regulatory text should also reflect that, or whether we're comfortable with just the preamble.
Well, and just a note that I highlighted, we do cite to 17 U.S.C. 107, which has the fair use definition under the Copyright Act.
Yeah, that's great. I think getting it into, you know, as Arian has reminded us, preamble is not regulation text, and if we want it to be clear to both end users and vendors, it seems like we need to reiterate this in regulation text.
Yeah, I would make exceptions for things where you are using terms that have well-established meanings, and fair use is one of those terms that has a well-established meaning. It clearly doesn't have a well-established meaning in the medical community. But in the legal community, I think anybody who looks at the word fair use knows what that means.
It does have another meaning.
We deal with the journal articles,
sure.
We deal with education. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah,
it does. Is fair use a defined term in any?
You could say fair use has the meaning defined by
I've seen that regulatory test.
It appears six times in the reg text.
The reg text or the preamble?
Sorry, in the reg text and the preamble.
Yeah.
Well, so in the Copyright Act, I can read it to you what they define it as, but you could make the suggestion that we pull language from the Copyright Act to clarify, I guess.
It's the usual thing that you've done where you can say in the definition section that this term has the meaning ascribed to it by, in the same way that you did for providers. Provider says the meaning as defined by Public Health Service Act.
I mean, you could that'd be a fine recommendation, I think, you know, if you want to do that.
I'm just commenting that there's actually a reference there to 17 U.S.C. 107. What is 17 U.S.C.
107? Yeah, but it's down there in a footnote.
It's the Copyright Act.
So we have the reference in it already.
Yeah.
We do.
We'll just put it in the reference.
Yeah, I think.
So this is, and I'm personally less concerned after learning about exactly how it's referenced, because it seems like it's not just for the things that, So I think it's fine, personally, to add in the fair use one. One question for usability and such, is it implied anywhere that it's you're only allowed to talk about it when it's showing a negative, like, oh, there's a usability problem or interoperability problem in the health IT? Because positive is okay, right? Because a lot of the times what you want to share is what's good about what the EHR is letting you do in terms, like, for publication. It's not that, you know, compared to, like, showing things that, like, horribly didn't work, like, it's much more common that you're wanting to share how it did work well.
Ken,
I think the issue is when are you going to, in the typical scenario, when would you have not gotten permission from the vendor? If you call up a vendor and say, look, I've got some amazing results with this, let's call it an alert in the system, they're going to say, go for it. It's when they have a negative outcome that they generally are concerned. So,
That being true as well, I mean, even for things that are good, they'll often cut out a lot of things that I would think are, you know, relevant things surrounding it that shows more context, or, you know, even for things that have been approved previously for a public presentation, even for, like, something that another task force in HITECH asked for that I have gotten approval for, like, five times prior to share those screenshots, I have to go through, again, seeking permission. Can I use these screenshots that I've got permission, you know, five times before, because I can't get permission to use it indefinitely for similar kind of presentations? Like, what kind of thing where, like, it can be arbitrary, right?
Guys, okay, we need to stop this conversation at this point because we have a lot of other things to get through. I think I've got enough input from the group that I will try and distill this. I will go back and look at this. The outstanding question around this section is the point that I've raised. I want us to consider this. About whether there is sufficient teeth in here to prevent a developer actually saying, well, that wasn't fair use. Okay? That was what he brought up, is his other point. And whilst it is considered inside the preamble, there isn't anything deliberately specifically called out in the reg text apart from what we see here. Do we think this is sufficient? And with the preamble obviously saying, you can't do that, you can't stand in the way. Do we think there's something the reg text needs to reflect that in addition, or are we comfortable with it as it stands?
Well, it might be worthwhile just enumerating the cases that people have complained about. So, for example, using screenshots for both positive and negative usability.
Yep.
Discussing poor usability, discussing safety-related issues.
Those are protected communications already.
Right, exactly. So I'm trying to get at what are the practices that somebody would be concerned would not be permitted.
I think the practices we're comfortable on is the, do we want to say something specific that a vendor cannot stand in the way outside the preamble, because the preamble already says it.
I don't think you need to say that because of the enforcement provision. If I'm a provider organization and my vendor is telling me that you can't share that, that's not fair use, and I know clearly it is fair use, and they take action against me, I'm going to go through the process to file a complaint.
Yeah.
Vendors don't want that. I mean, that provides some teeth in this law because they are certified under the program. They don't want to jeopardize their certification. So if they really are being unreasonable, and you go, okay, fine, I'm going to take this.
Okay. Is that the general consensus?
I think it is, because the logical conclusion, if we were to entertain Raj's position, would be that in every case where it's a small guy against a bigger guy, but a bigger guy has deeper pockets, we'd be in the same situation. So why would we deal with
that's
that
right.
issue now?
So on behalf of the task force, I'll go back to Raj directly and just fill him in on our position and why we think this is actually taken care of in the current drafting. And if that's okay with everybody? Yeah, okay. So let's move on then.
This is Jenny. I just wanted to throw in, I mean, like, as a provider, we use screenshots all day long for training and everything. And if our vendor doesn't prohibit that, none of this applies, right? If our vendor doesn't take a hard line, like apparently some vendors do, say you have to get our permission, we use them in presentations, everything. So we're not putting some kind of burden on us that we don't already have, right?
I think the question came in full committee based upon an experience, and we, having discussed it, believe that we have sufficient levers inside the regulations as currently expressed, and I'll go back and help guide Raj through that because some of this happened in the preamble.
Yeah, I mean, if a vendor wants to provide more liberty,
I don't need it.
That's
the vendor's decision.
That's their decision. And so, charge on.
I know you're trying to move on, but just a real quick comment for the screen, like, distortion part. Could we just make sure there's some language saying, like, blurring to remove content is okay? Because that's something, for example, vendors oftentimes will want, and then trying to protect the IP, I think that's oftentimes what the vendors request, and I think it'd be kind of weird if this reg makes it so you can't do that, where you might want to show more of a screen, but in order to, so you get the general sense of everything's laid out, but you may want to blur things out, especially at the request of the vendor, and if it says you can't, then I think that would be kind of counterintuitive, but it might be, you know, baked into this. So, like, distortion, but, like, excluding, you know, blurring to remove, you know, sensitive data or something like that. I think that would be in everyone's
interest. Totally redacted.
Yeah. Distortion. Yeah, that's right. Distortion with the exception of appropriate redaction.
Yeah.
I think that's been introduced. I don't want to keep extending this conversation, but that's going to introduce another level of complexity. My definition of appropriately redacted may be different than yours.
I
think the intent here is that if you're sharing a screenshot and you're saying there's some horrendous usability issue in EHRX, then that does not cover effectively libel or, you know, creating a Photoshop version of EHRX that is wrong.
I'll make a note to have a think about the redaction. We'll know how to balance it because fair use would, you know, if it's not redacted, then that's not fair use. And so I'll have a ponder on that one. I do want to move on.
It's actually covered in D1 because it says that you cannot require alteration except to redact PHI.
Okay. In the actual screenshot section.
Yes. So the vendor couldn't require under this provision that type of redaction or blurring, but it's not eliminated if you wanted to redact for some reason.
Okay.
Yeah, because screenshots.
I think that's good. Even if the vendor requests, if it's not actually necessary, you know, please just blur it out. I think that's totally reasonable, and you know, but yeah, I mean, I think it'd be important to have the option for the, you know, share to redact out thing or blur out things like what the other buttons look like or, you know, whatever that's legitimate IP that isn't really necessary.
Yeah, and can I ask one more question? One more question on fair use. Is that, and within the definition of fair use, I don't have it in front of me, is anything about length of time for review? So if I ask the question to be able to share and whatnot, and I do have a question out there, I have the situation where a vendor just waits forever to get back to me, and then suddenly I just give up frustrated. I mean, is there anything here about unnecessary delay or something to that effect?
Need permission for fair use.
That's what this regulation is going to provide.
No, I know. I just want to make sure that's covered. I don't have it in front of me. I just want to make sure that is covered in there. That's all.
And to Sasha's point, D1 covers this neatly. because it talks about both redaction and concealing protected health information. So I think.
Okay.
Okay.
You just need to make sure you're using it under fair use.
And,
and you have a decent lawyer.
Like me.
Yeah, and you have a decent lawyer.
Let's move on. We're now going to move into something else that came from work group two around the exceptions. Specifically, we're going to talk about fees and permitted fees that can be charged. There has been, for those of you not on work group two, there has been even more conversation about this topic than any other topic we've had across any of the work groups, which may astonish you.
Money.
More than price transparency, even.
Money.
But it is about money. So I've asked our learned friend, you can't be Oracle Oracles, you can't be Sage of Sages, because they're already occupied by Mark and Mike.
Yep.
So Arian is going to actually lead us through. He's done the lion's share of the drafting. Mark, can you switch to work group two, please?
Yeah, I'm working. I'm working on it. I'll get up in a second.
You're doing that. Let me just set up the discussion.
Please.
Because I think the work group appropriately deliberated on this topic. There was a fair amount of discussion. The sense of the work group, number one, was that the way that 171, 204, and 206 were divided up made it hard to understand what fees were and weren't permitted. So just for context, 171.204 covers costs reasonably incurred, and 171.206 covers IP considerations or licensing for interoperability elements, and that it would be better to have a single section covering permitted fees. Andy and I had this lengthy discussion about this yesterday, but the way to think about this is that any fee is inherently a restriction on interoperability unless it is permitted.
It's a slightly contorted way
of thinking about it. But once you're in the frame of what are permitted fees, then it's a lot easier to wrap your head around the language. The second thread of discussion, we had a lot of very detailed discussions about the specific provisions in 204 and 206, but the second thread of discussion was to recognize that there is a distinction between activities for exchange or use that are value added, to which for which market forces are this are a sufficient mechanism for establishing fair pricing, and other activities for which that are impeded by potential rent seeking behavior, where market forces are not an appropriate mechanism for establishing pricing. So we tried to get at in our discussion, we tried to get at the distinction between appropriate pricing mechanics that address rent-seeking behavior and ensure that data flows, and distinguish that from other kinds of services that, where we believe that market forces are appropriate. And the way that we did this was to make a distinction between, number one, access, and in particular access to what the work group discussed as the legal medical record. So there's a strong consensus that access to, and then this quasi-defined term of the legal medical record, and there's a little bit of difficulty with this term that I'll get into just to make sure people have the context for the discussion. But that access to the legal medical record should not be impeded, and that there are particular forms of IPR that stand in the way of both access, exchange, or all of access, exchange, and use, and that the pricing regulation that we should be contemplating is focused on basic access and then activities that impede IPR that impedes access, exchange, and use. An example of IPR that could impede access, exchange, or use is, for example, a code set that is not licensed by the U.S. federal government. So many, just for, again, purposes of reference, because I don't think many people understand this, many of the code sets that are called out in standards are licensed by ILM for blanket use in the United States. There are exceptions. One of those exceptions is a procedural terminology that is extensively used by the largest federal payer. And the way that the vendor or society that licenses that IPR often licenses that IPR is by not just licensing the use for the organization that is using that terminology in their software, but also licenses the downstream use of that terminology. And the way that copyright law works is that the kind of bare code can't be copyrighted, but the description can be, which means that...
I was as diplomatic as you.
If you're confused, yes, we're talking about CPT. Which means that you could share the code, but you couldn't share the interpretation of the code to downstream users. So that would be an activity where IPR could inhibit the access, exchange, or use of the information. So that was the broad policy framework or explanatory framework or background.
The lens by which we consider.
The lens by which we consider.
Let's just get Mark. Mark, can you just quickly go back to the group two, please, and search for the words, Mark-scroll-to-here for TF meeting. Just look for the word scroll, just to a control.
Oh, you put it in there, huh? Mark.
Actually, there you go. What's that?
Was that it?
Just look for the word scroll. It's definitely in there.
It's under,
sure?
Under 204.
Yeah.
Okay.
So first of all, I just want to make sure that the broader group understands the perspective that the work group used and make sure that we have either consensus or discuss any lack of consensus with the policy framework. And then we can give the language that's being proposed to make sure that the language accords with the policy framework.
So the policy framework you're proposing, Arian, is to combine the two different sections be there, and then also within the new combined section to distinguish between what you're calling basic access, the definition of which is hinging on this legal medical record concept that we have to discuss further, and then other types of activity that would be market-based in their pricing? I follow.
Because the original drafting did entertain the fact it's legitimate to make profits, okay, and it's legitimate to do expense recovery, but we just wanted to make sure we differentiate between the two.
Yep. Okay, so...
Great conversation.
So there is a large amount of discussion text and background in the recommendations that we can go back and refer to that kind of motivate some of this. But if we actually look at the recommendations, so first some high-level recommendations that just establish the policy framework, and then some more detailed recommendations address the more specifics. So, you know, first of all, we recommend combining the two sections into a single section so that if you can look at one section to understand what fees are and aren't allowed to charge. Second recommendation is make sure that, and this was related to the reg text that described cost recovery and a preamble text that describes that reasonable profits would be allowed. And the task force found that confusing. And so there's some suggested language in terms of pure cost or expense recovery with no provision for margin or profit, cost-based pricing where margin or profit is allowed, and market-based pricing where the market sets the price as the appropriate terms to use. And let's make sure that those are distinguished. So where cost-based pricing mechanisms are required, we should rather than say the task force, we should say the committee. We should, there's a lot of text here basically saying we should allow for reasonable heuristics. So many HIEs in practice use OE or revenue or other kinds of metrics as base proxy metrics for the size of an organization, where the size of the organization tends to correspond to the exchange activity of that organization. And to the extent that you allow cost plus or cost recovery, pure cost recovery mechanisms, you should also allow reasonable heuristics, and right now those would be prohibited by text. All right, now we get into the fun stuff. Task Force recommends that ONC distinguish between basic access, and there's a whole bunch of ways of getting at this concept, the data or facts about the patient or patients, legal medical record, designated record set. Just one little nuance here that I think ONC may need to go figure out, or we could help ONC figure out, is that if you think about the designated record set, the designated record set is already has the mechanisms for describing claiming, remittance, and any of the pricing associated with claiming a remittance. That's already covered under the concept of a designated record set. It's already established in regulation. I think the reason that ONC went to the definition of electronic health information that they did is that I think there's a legitimate question as to whether the designated record set would apply to prospective pricing information, I think there's an argument to make that the designated record set would apply to prospective pricing information, but that's not a usage that's firmly established in regulation or in usual practice. So the designated record set is defined as effectively any data that's used to make decisions about the patient, and it specifically includes claiming and remittance associated with an encounter. It doesn't specifically include prospective pricing. And I think the reason that ONC chose the EHI definition that they did is to fall under the definition prospective price information. So the way that we're framing basic access, we might want to consider or contemplate also access to prospective pricing information specific to the patient. Yeah.
So a couple of points coming off that. One is, I think my feeling is that I recognize what was going on with the EHI definition around perspective. I think that is moving the ball forward, and it's allowing us to put the tracks in place to support future transparency efforts. I think, and that's what we have been asked to do and discuss, and that seems right. So going back to the use of the various different terminology and classification type sets.
Yeah.
Okay. We also have conversation around standards essential.
We'll get there.
Yeah. Do they, you did wax very diplomatically about the downstream licensing of classifications and coding. Are we inadvertently or are we deliberately suggesting that they all are standards essential?
Hold on. Yes.
We are. Okay.
Get there.
Okay. I do like this dynamically editing it in real time.
Yeah. So, under the term basic access, I think a reasonable person would believe that basic access should include access through certified standards. Reasonably required to enable access or implement the use of intended use of certified technology. So there is a practice that is often used where I, as an EHR vendor, I purchase a resulting interface or I purchase resulting or ordering capability, and then I need to go purchase the resulting or ordering interface on top of it. In this context, this language is contemplating that use of standards reasonably essential or reasonably required to enable access would be included in the definition of basic access and would therefore be included in the definition of... Okay. Would be included, and you'll see later where basic access gets hooked in. So I just wanted to call that out.
So just to amplify that, when we say basic access, what does that mean in terms of fees that come in that proposal legitimately charged?
Yeah, so in this text, we are contemplating pure cost recovery for basic access, not cost plus, but pure cost recovery for basic access.
And therefore, I think we're saying that additional interfaces which conform to certified standards would be considered basic access.
Correct.
Therefore, cost recovery purely.
Correct.
Okay.
Right. Now, if you offer another kind of interface that is not a certified standard, or it's not the interface that you used for gaining certification, or it's not a standard that's reasonably required to enable that form of access, that does not form the term of basic access. So we're not trying to.
And that would also include localization coding and all that kind of stuff.
There are some discussion points later on. We'll get to, but there is a nuance relating to forms where it would be permitted to charge fees, and those would be relating to use of, for example, if a provider required the use of non-standard terminology. Or data that was in the chart that was non-standard, or these are real examples. Examples where there are results that are in the chart that came from a lab that did not use LOINC, and there's custom mapping that's required. Those kinds of things basically should be at market rates, because if the vendor provides appropriate interfaces and access to that information, then the vendor could provide those services, or you could contract with a systems integrator, and there's already existing market-based pricing to establish that. All right. So that's the recommendation relative to basic access. Second paragraph. Yeah, go ahead.
Do we have enumerated out anywhere inside the regulations what the certified standards are?
Sure.
We do. Do we actually have that exhaustive list?
Absolutely.
And so we don't need to have any of the examples in here.
Absolutely.
Right, let's take out the examples.
Now, there are some issues where ONC has removed standards because the corresponding meaningful use definition was removed. So, for example, ONC had a standard for LRI and LOI.
Yep.
And then removed them because CMS declared the LRI standard, or described electronic reporting.
That's why I'm responding to it.
As topped
you
out.
It as an example.
Yeah, I did use it as an example very deliberately.
Wouldn't it be more helpful if we went back and made some recommendations to correct that list?
Sure.
You know, and I think, can we?
We can make any recommendations.
Request that we have access to do that, please.
We can make any. Oh.
Yeah, we can make any
recommendations. Yeah. Well, it's not our bounded remit right now.
Got it. Yeah, yeah.
We'll increase our charter because we'll have time.
Yeah. So at 30,000 feet.
Yes, ma'am.
Part of the EHI is for the patient to have access to payment information as for the future.
Yep.
And a big issue when we interview patients and understand their toughest situations are they're getting fragmented bills months later, sometimes 7 months later, and they're surprise billing, and they don't match up, and they even sophisticated patients do their own Excel spreadsheets, and they have piles of bills that are overwhelming. And they don't. It's like So the long and the short of it is that's part of the medical record. So what are we looking at on the standard setting? Why not just have HL7 include payment along with the clinical information, the payment information, so that also the my kids get Venmo and they
so
use Venmo.
That's what we're going back to list because.
Yes, and this could just be an HL7 fire standard.
Yeah. There is one actually. So there's an EOB standard that CMS is using and is part of what they reference for MA plans.
Mm-hmm.
It provides access to the retrospective remit, not to the prospective payment.
Correct, but it's still in the HL7 fire.
It's still an HL7 fire standard.
Standard.
Yeah.
So why not? That's
And that's actually a listed standard.
That's kind of what we just
That's actually proposed as a listed standard, and it would be applied to the payer list that was described yesterday by Alex.
Arian, can you take a moment and just clarify what you mean by prospective payment data? I understand retrospective, sort of what's been paid in the past, but what is included in that prospective?
Would be,
just as clarification, prospective would be I'm going to CPMC, or I'm thinking about going to CPMC, and I'm going to have a knee replacement surgery or hip replacement surgery. Prospective payment would be, what is that going to cost?
Why don't you call it price?
Okay, so Cynthia.
Yeah.
Why don't you call it the real price?
Well, healthcare is super complicated, and the real price is actually the post-adjudicated
contract.
The post-adjudicated contract price is established between the payer and the provider.
That's what I'm trying to get.
She wants to be able to say that we have put in place the tracks so that a patient, when they're going to receive care, will have that. An inkling, let's just say the inkling I'm being, of what that post-adjudicated cost is going to be, because the payer would have done a pre-adjudication on it, etc.
Well, if we took Les's big idea, right,
yeah.
We have our mobile device, we have it adjudicated, and we say, okay, the Brigham wants to do a knee replacement.
So
what's it going to cost there? And what's it going to cost if I go to Stewart instead?
So if you look at what we can do here, we can put in place the conduit to allow that communication to take place if it's being supported.
Yes.
And from what you're suggesting here, the conduit for any event, whether it's past, current, or pre, to understand the pricing around that would be supported within basic access.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Hang on with me. Yeah.
Just a quick question. I want to make sure I didn't mishear this. Did I hear that EOBs are part of the legal medical record? That's not my understanding.
If you read the definition of designated record set under HIPAA, then the designated record set includes all of the payment information.
So if a hospital gets an EOB or the EOBs that are part of the care of a patient.
So an EOB is an explanation of benefit. What the hospital actually gets is a remit, but that's.
In order to get prospective pricing, they have some exchange happening, right? You're saying that if I were to request my legal medical record, all those documents have to be provided as well.
That's in the definition, the payment information.
Well, that's I'm talking just legal medical record, right?
Yeah. So the designated record set. We can go to the definition of designated record set under HIPAA.
Okay.
But the designated record set under HIPAA, we can pull it up.
Okay. That's fine.
I have it right here.
Okay.
It includes payment information. Right. Past,
and
present, and future.
A patient can ask
it
on the individual right of access for all of that information.
Yep.
So this is the thing. Okay. We don't want the patient to have to ask. Because the patient is part of their record. So if you can get, what is the adjudicated price, quote? Okay, wait.
Likely to be, because it hasn't been adjudicated yet. Remember, it's not happened, so it can't be adjudicated because the event hasn't happened yet. So pre-adjudicated price.
And then again, just to be super clear, unfortunately, the way that CURES was written, it applies to providers, health IT developers, health information exchanges, and health information networks. Does not apply to payers.
It doesn't apply to payers.
Does not apply to payers.
Well, wait a minute. Because if a payer is part of a health information exchange.
Yes.
Or if they're part of
if a payer is
integrated
part of
delivery network.
If they're part of an integrated
that's
delivery network.
That's why the definition of health information exchange is very important.
That's why we did so that we include as an HIA.
Yep.
Well, a payer has to be included because they are exchanging information on that patient. And that's why I keep going back to the CURES Act, and I'm happy to provide this for you.
Hard copy. This is almost
okay,
information blocks.
Okay, you can read the law, you can read the CURES Act, you can read the reference from HIPAA. But sit with me on this, because as a patient, what I was trying to go at on the payment information, even if they get, what's not working today is the payers are saying, oh, we have cost estimators. Go there for what it's going to cost you.
Well, and guess what? An estimate isn't reality. Okay, so when a big hospital system, what's it really going to cost me?
Yeah.
Then the bills come in dribs and drabs, okay?
Yep.
And they come up to 7 months on average later than the actual procedure, okay? And we are finding that time and time again, the patient has no idea what it's going to cost and what the price, real price is. They can't shop. They can't see where can I most efficiently get my knee replacement to me and to my employer, okay? And then they, what we want to provide them, because by law, since 96, this information is part of their electronic record. And you can say, yes, it is identifiable. If you want to take your identifiable definition, the payment is identifiable to the patient. And the adjudication goes back and forth, and they have the rate. The rates are already negotiated with my TPA or my insurer up front. So it's in the electronic record. And now we have it that is already standardized with FHIR and HL7. So why can't the patients get, for the first start, they should get their payment information digitally that they could get it on their mobile app
along with their
clinic. So
what we're seeking to do, and what Arian's done with this drafting, is to put that information set within this definition of basic access.
Yep.
So that the track is there to allow that information to flow.
Yeah, we're laying
right now,
that's right.
The hurdles out of the way.
That's the right metaphor.
So,
we're laying
so
the
we
track.
Don't have to go to HL7 and ask them for a standard because there already is one.
Absolutely.
There already is one.
Yeah. Financial records is already part of the HL7. There's a whole domain in HL7.
Okay. So can we confirm that if we appropriately utilize the definition of health information exchange, the payers are in this bucket too for being part of information blocking
issue. The network is
issue.
In. The network is
in.
Going
to require them.
Yeah, CMS will require them.
They're required to be a part of an exchange.
Hang on. The definition of a network is one that's also used and misused across the industry. You know? We will, as a task force, go back and look at the electronic health information definition to ensure that it's within the spirit of what CURES was looking to do.
Yeah.
And I'll commit that.
Excuse me.
It's not what we're looking at today. But we do need to go back and check the CHI numbers. I've got it here, and I'm going to go through this.
Yeah.
Okay.
Can I just add, Andy? This is Stephen. Just again, what we heard from CMS.
His hand wasn't
up. My voice is
up.
I'm sorry.
You get permission because it's very early. Go ahead.
Thank you. What we heard from CMS yesterday, what Alex, was that the payers need to be part of a trusted exchange framework. Not network. So I think we just have to be clear on those terms to make sure that indeed, the payers get captured in all of this.
Yeah, and also just to be really clear, and this is just me in pedantic. This is just me in pedantic rules mode. And this is why I was trying to drive the distinction between the payers that CMS has regulatory authority over and the payers CMS doesn't have regulatory authority over yesterday. But the access provisions would be to the network that the payer is part of, not to the payer themselves. So there may be other legislative or regulatory mechanisms required to further open prospective price transparency from payers. But to Andy's point, the intent here is to open up many or most of the rails that are currently impeding access to both clinical information, prospective payment, and retrospective payment information. All right.
So on that.
Hey, Andy.
Cynthia, please.
Aren't we just looking for, since it's already been done on the payment for HL7, aren't we just looking for the pipe and shouldn't it be very efficient to do the price in HL7 then too?
The retrospective price, yes. The prospective price, there's not yet a standard for that.
Yeah, no, but I'm saying
the
standard exists for payment.
There's no policy to make it happen.
That's right. There's no policy to make
there's
it
happen. There's a standard to convey the information.
Right.
And we're opening the pipes to enable that, but there's no health policy decision to be made.
Well, there actually are, because it's part of conditions of participation. CMS is now also requiring hospitals to list their published
this isn't for us to
we have a lot.
John's had his hand up. We need to
Yeah,
we put in place the framework to allow that information to flow, there is other machinations going on to force, to instruct that information should flow.
Yes. The question I have is, do we go to the HL7 group and say, here, just as in payment is supposed to be there, price needs to be there to HL7.
Yes.
And that becomes a recommendation
from the
tech
board. I would invite you to come to the board of HL7 and we'll have that conversation there.
Yeah.
And they will say, the domain, it's already in the domain. And
it's already in the domain, so it should be very efficient.
Yeah.
Because
it's
there.
Andy.
John's trying to get his...
If we're not going to use the raised hand function, could you at least pause occasionally for those who are on the phone and just inquire? Sorry, it's just hard. I mean, the point I'm trying to make was like 5 minutes ago. I just wanted to clarify I didn't want a misconception to keep be an important part of the conversation. So with the disclaimer that the definition of HIE and HIN is currently very broad, what we traditionally think of as an HIE, when payers share data with them, it's, in my experience, uncommon for that information to include pricing or cost. It's claims, utilization information, clinical information, but the financial information is stripped out. So I just didn't want that misconception to be part of people's logic.
And John, I have a perspective on that, which is why there's discussion later on relating to contractual provisions. Very often, even when, our legal counsel, Change Healthcare's legal counsel, had a fascinating example of a case where even where price transparency information was allowed under our BAA terms to be shared, one of the parties to the network sued us over confidentiality, saying that price information, notwithstanding that it was shared electronically, was confidential information not to be shared. It got litigated, and the courts decided against that sharing. So in many cases where price information is not being shared, it is not being shared because either A, it's not formed part of the BAA terms, or B, confidentiality terms are being used
to crystal clear for everybody,
prevent that sharing.
The reason it's not being shared is procedural and policy related,
correct,
not capability of the standard to share.
Exactly. Exactly.
Oh, one could call it collusion among big players to be opaque.
Right. And we wouldn't call it collusion.
And we discussed that point explicitly later on in the contractual provision sections.
Yeah.
Because it is a significant term. Okay, I'm going to keep going.
Please do, because
Yeah.
So just a question. That said, out of this task force, if EOBM payment happens that way, what we want to do is empower the patient efficiently to get that billing data.
Absolutely.
The billing and payment data.
Yep,
absolutely.
Comprehensively.
Remove the hurdles.
Absolutely.
That's exactly what we're here for.
And if you have no pricing, you sit overwhelmed because you are surprised.
Yes.
Okay, with, 6,000 anesthesiologists out of the network for Kona. So you have no voice to say, I didn't know. And now you're stuck with this bill or an 18,000 genetics test
So we enable the information to flow so those kinds of problems can be addressed.
Yes.
That's right. Okay.
Okay.
Great.
This is Benny. I just wanted to make sure we're clear that the provider doesn't have the EOB information. The payer has the EOB information.
The provider does have the remit when it comes back.
We don't know how much of their deductible they've met.
Correct. That's right.
Right. We don't have all that other information.
We
know what we got paid, and we know what our contract is, but we don't know the specifics on that individual.
Yeah.
That's a payer thing.
That's right.
Okay. It's not for this group
to
litigate through how to change health policy to make some of these things happen. That's for elsewhere. But we recognize that's going to be needed for this to be used.
But this is the question. Okay. In the food chain of the financial transaction, there is a time when the provider knows what they're going to get paid before they do the procedure.
No.
No. Sometimes. Sometimes not. They know the cost that they have to perform the procedure.
They don't know that either.
No.
Potentially.
They
have potentially
a, they
not.
Have a
they know the procedure that
price.
They know the DRG or the CPT code
yeah,
that they're going to charge.
Yeah.
But they know they
have a CPT code. They have it bundled and unbundled. The DRG, CPT code, bundled and unbundled,
totally.
Right?
Yeah.
And then they know the contractual negotiated rate with that insurer.
If they're good.
They have a rate. They have
yeah,
a rate
it's
card.
More complicated
if they're
than
good.
Because there is, you know, we are off track and we are going to come back on track in about 2 minutes, okay? But there are, inside the provider, there are many different routes by which what gets billed gets defined.
Mm-hmm.
And at the point the procedure is conducted, that may or may not be absolutely known.
So if,
leave it like that.
Okay,
yeah.
So this is on the standard setting on the pipe.
This is nothing to do with the standard.
No, I have
product.
A question on the
yeah.
pipe.
Yeah.
On the pipe, because you guys know the on the pipe of that standard now, on the financial negotiated
yeah.
rate between the provider and the payer,
yep.
What is the standard that they're using now?
X12.
X12.
Yeah. The
837. So
yeah.
How?
Okay, so that's named. It's named. Yeah, it's
that, named Greg. That's not the contracted. That's not a standard for the contracted rate. The standard for the contracted rate is a contract in a file cabinet someplace that,
yeah.
if we're good, as someone mentioned, we can build into our system to try to estimate and to anticipate what we should have gotten paid.
Anyway, let's.
Yeah, move on.
Let's keep going.
Now,
yeah.
I mean,
let's get back to what
Alan
is trying to do.
That there is no such thing as a simple price
yes.
that is available to answer all the questions that we're talking about right now.
And we're not going to solve that.
That's
no,
not
we're
going
to set up.
We can open the pipes.
One of our other recommendations to set up a group that will spend time going through all of this. Because, like, we've got a whole bunch of other things we're supposed to get done
yeah.
here. Yeah, no, I was just looking at the pipe.
Yeah.
The conversion to HL7 of that
intellectual property rate.
Pipe.
Yep.
Laying the groundwork for the pipe. It shouldn't
okay,
be a big
so
deal.
I think
right?
we are going to move on.
Yeah.
Okay. The point is the standards exist.
Yeah.
The standards can be utilized. We need to make sure that they are going.
Correct.
Everything is clear, so they will be utilized.
That's
and that information, there is no reason for that information to be blocked.
Right. And
yeah.
having that information flow will enable many of the services that will establish price transparency.
And what we're going to discuss is what's legitimate to charge
yeah.
for enabling
right.
that information sharing.
Okay. So.
That's what this conversation is supposed to be about.
Charge whom?
Charges.
Yeah.
Okay.
So this. Next paragraph was an agreement in the task force that there well may be value-added services. So the example that's given here is a risk scoring service. There may well be value-added services that are then incorporated into the chart and used to make decisions under the definition of a designated record set that's already part of the chart and is already related to basic access. All right. Task force or committee recommends that ONC distinguish between IPR, the intellectual property rights, that are essential or is essential to access, thank you, to access, exchange, and use, to use the basic facts, and essential IPR would include standards, essential IPR, so that's any IPR that's named in a standard and reasonably required to use that standard. There's a well-established amount of law relative to standards essential IPR that's actually well named in the preamble.
Is this still certification standards or any standards?
That's a great point. It's a great point.
I think we should be defining the certified standards.
Certified standards.
That.
Yes, that's right.
I've got a question on this.
Yeah.
Different standards have different remuneration models around them. So something like SNOMED CT is paid for as a countrywide license by
right.
ALM. Something like CPT is obviously,
yep.
as we discussed. Doesn't this potentially have the, I don't even know, is it unintended effect of saying actually pushing people towards using something like a SNOMED?
Yes.
Terminology versus CPT because
I think it would have the intended effect of pushing.
It's a consequence. It's not
I think it would have the intended effect. Yeah. This distinction of an essential intellectual property rights would have the intended effect of making sure that the AMA licensed CPT in terms that met the RAND pricing terms. Yes.
Okay.
Now,
that'd be interesting to see the AMA conversation about this point.
Well, I'm sure that they'll have comment and they'll provide their comment to ONC. That doesn't mean that if we think it's the right thing to do, it doesn't mean that we should recommend.
It's all about money, isn't it?
Yeah. All right. Okay. So now we get to the money section of this discussion. We recommend that fees allowed for basic access be on pure direct cost recovery basis only. In many cases where basic access is provided via widely deployed consensus-based standards, that should be certified standards, built into Health IT, such direct costs would be minimal. Task Force does not recommend the cost to develop standards be part of the cost basis for fees for basic access. Believes this provides a significant incentive to adopt standards.
So definition of direct cost. When you say pure direct cost,
that
can have several different meanings. So I could turn around and say, actually, the labor that I'm going to have to charge to make something happen for you, that's a direct cost.
That is a direct cost. So what we're excluding as part of the calculation for direct cost is the development cost to develop the certified standard that's already required to get the application certified. Mm-hmm. And you'll see also not include reasonable mapping to standards. So reasonable mapping would be defined as mapping of proprietary terminology used internally.
And that's not basic access.
That is part of basic access.
Mappings are part of basic access.
So just to be clear.
I like that.
The intent of this section is to say, if I have, as an EHR developer, a custom code set that I used for procedural coding or for condition coding, and I'm required to make that access via SNOMED, I should not be allowed to charge for the one-time mapping of that custom procedural code to SNOMED. Later on, exceptions would include cases where data or terminology sets exist that are not reasonable to include in mapping to standards and where sufficient mechanisms of basic access exposing the non-standard data exist. And I'm more than happy to make this clearer if this is not clear. So the intent here is that as an EHR developer, if I have an internal proprietary code set that I use and I, to make it available via a consolidated CDI, I've got to map to SNOMED, that one-time cost of mapping between my internal code set and SNOMED is part of the cost of providing that standard. If the way that I license my software, I allow my providers to customize, add additional procedural terminology or additional condition terminology or problem terminology, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, then my obligation as an EHR vendor is to make the data available, and the costs incurred to do the additional mapping would be basically on the provider to achieve, either through the vendor or through a systems integrator.
At market rate.
At market rate. You probably need to call this out a little bit clearer.
Okay.
I think where a vendor builds a new feature to enable information sharing,
if that
new feature conforms to a certified standard,
mm-hmm.
how would they charge for that as a product upgrade?
They would typically charge for the product upgrade associated with the certified module. I don't know, Sasha, you're closer to this, but in our experience...
Would they be able to charge?
Can you give the scenario again?
The way this is worded, they might not be able to.
So, I'll give a personal experience of one person's way of addressing some of this complexity, which is that when in areas when we have sold, when I have sold certified, in this case, e-prescribing or resulting modules, the interfaces were included as part of the price. But if there was a new version of that software to be certified to edition 2015 and not edition 2011 or whatever it was, or 2014, or you've gotten.
Okay, but these are exceptions to information blocking.
Yeah.
They're not in the maintenance or certification section,
right.
So they're not specific to certified.
I can charge. Nothing limits the EHR vendor's ability to charge for the EHR technology itself.
Agreed. But does this inadvertently say they can't charge for interoperability technology?
What it effectively requires is to bundle the standards-based access as part of the certified technology.
Can we not use the word bundle? But these are in exceptions. They're
yep.
not in certified health IT maintenance certification.
Nothing in this section addresses what anybody can charge for
their
software. This is purely about information blocking relating to exchange, to access exchange or use.
So if I understand this, and this is new to me, so you're proposing that there might be a pricing model where a particular software product sold both a software license
mm-hmm.
and then additional interoperability elements such as an interface.
Yep.
Some of those interfaces might fall under this basic access if
Correct.
They were, for example, the e-prescribing interfaces that are referenced in the certification standard, other
yep.
interfaces or interoperability elements that are part of that might be separate. And you're saying that the software license for the module itself, which would include any kind of upgrades, if those were something that were charged for, would be at market prices.
Yep.
It's the interoperability elements,
Correct.
Particularly in this case, the ones required for basic access, mm-hmm. Such as the interfaces that would be named in the certification standard, that would be at pure direct cost recovery basis.
Correct.
And interoperability elements that would not be part of that basic access could then be charged at market
Correct.
Rate. I don't know if that example maybe helped crystallize.
Yeah.
I have a question. So, I mean, if I was a health IT vendor, based on what you just described, and I can charge what I want for my EHR software, but I can't charge for the interface.
Yeah.
I'm just going to build it into my price of my EHR
Absolutely.
Software. So how is that going to be regulated, what you chose to build into the price of your EHR software, whether it was the actual cost of the interface?
No,
we can't do that now. We can't figure that out now. So the question will the market then just decide,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
I think the question is that you shouldn't charge anything incremental.
That's right.
That is,
yeah, because what?
If I buy a results module, then the results is a particularly bad example because we removed, e-prescribing is a great one.
And
so if I buy an e-prescribing module, my expectation should be the price I pay for buying the e-prescribing module, and I should be able to compare vendor A, vendor B, and vendor C. The expectation I should have is that I buy the e-prescribing module. It's a certified EHR module. It should include all of the costs
I absolutely
associated
agree.
With
I
doing e-prescribing.
I saw this with immunizations.
Yep.
I had a number of small provider organizations that said, we bought the immunization capability.
That's a totally different
and,
issue.
And now we're getting charged
yep.
to connect it.
That is a totally different issue because the EHR module that you bought where there is a defined standard in this pricing approach, that standards-based interoperability would be included in the price of the immunization
right.
module.
That assumes you're
but the
standard.
State that uses a non-standard mechanism.
Oh, I told. But we didn't.
Yeah,
we
yeah.
Used, we used the standard.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they said, oh, now we have to pay $15,000 more.
Right, and that's pretty. That's a.
So we're gonna get rid of that problem.
Correct.
Okay, great.
The majority of EMR EHR contracts I've ever seen.
Like Prime.
Have many different aspects to the pricing, and interfaces and integration is always a separate carve-out.
Yep.
And there's sometimes a slim section, sometimes an extensive section, calling out specific interfaces that require construction. And I'm not going to pretend to understand the intricacies of how EMR vendors wish to do their pricing, but I'm moderately comfortable with assuming that there are different pricing approaches for different clients who want to see pricing in different places, whether that's a CapEx or an OpEx expenditure, and all sorts of other reasons why contracts are drawn the way they are. And we might inadvertently... Very pleasant, was it?
Yeah.
Music heard later. We might inadvertently...
Very nice.
Unintended consequence might be we actually start dictating how contracting could take place, and I don't think that's our intent either.
The intent, I'll just put it as simply as I can, the intent here is that if I buy certified module X, that any standards interfaces, any standards interfaces required for that certification are included in the price of X.
Could we call it certification? Because these are... We're in a section that isn't about certified health IT, it's about
right.
health IT.
Well, the there is an obligation, and I don't know if I wrote that, so we probably
any
should make sure.
Any functional module that I sell has to interoperate.
So there is also an obligation to provide, if there isn't a certified standard, there is an obligation at cost basis to provide basic access, independent of there being an existing standard.
We need to call that out.
Okay.
Specifically.
So the first sentence is the TF record. Yeah, and we can clarify the sentence. But the committee recommends that allowed fees for basic access be on a pure direct cost recovery basis only. Period. Second sentence. In many cases where basic access, this is on the top of this paragraph that's being highlighted right now by Mark. So, period. In many cases where basic access is provided via widely deployed consensus-based certified standards built into health IT, such direct costs would be minimal. And the intent here is that it is more expensive for a health IT vendor to make an ad hoc access to enable basic access than to enable that one time, particularly enable it one time via standards. That's the intent. You got to provide basic access. The cheapest and easiest way to provide basic access should be through a certified standard. I think we need to, I think per this discussion, I think we need to clarify this nuance of what mapping is and isn't included, because the intent is to include anything reasonably necessary to use the module as purchased, but not to include any places where I'm shooting myself in the foot. I modify, and many EHRs allow for modification of the procedural terminology or modification of the problem list terminology. Many EHR users like to have problems lists just problem list defined just so, and in some of those cases, those modifications are going to require additional costs to map to standards, and we shouldn't. That should not be the vendor's problem.
Where mappings have been created between a standard and something else, that mapping, does that now enter some kind of public domain usage,
no.
So vendor A and vendor B both need to conduct the same mapping between the same standard and the same localization, because they're being used in the same organization for different reasons. Why would it be a legitimate cost for that organization to bear twice?
So are you saying open source?
Within a very particular context, where you've got a mapping that's been created between a standard and something local inside this hospital system. And vendor A has done it and charged for it because it's legitimate.
Yep.
Okay. Vendor B has exactly the same mapping to do.
Yeah.
And they will charge for that again. Do we entertain that this does happen.
Yeah.
Repeatedly.
Sure.
So should it only be something that the provider has to incur a cost for?
That's a classic example. We've got
We can come up with examples.
FDB, Medispan, GoldRx, yep. All of them have proprietary medication terminologies, and they all sell mappings to RxNorm and NDC.
But that's different. They're mapping to their proprietary. What you're saying is there isn't proprietary. There's standard mapping.
There are localizations. There's local codes that's used all over the shop, okay? And I've got many hospital clients that have their own specific things for specific reasons, which you map to a standard. Another vendor working inside the same organization with a product which does something inside that organization would have to go and recreate the same mapping that they've already paid for once under another vendor.
They can negotiate to own that map if they wanted to. I mean, I think
I'm just wondering whether we should say silent on that, or
I think
we should say it's
because the alternative would be that we're gonna have that organization try to figure out which vendor are you going to subsidize with the other vendor.
Yeah.
The best way to do it would be to simply say, if you went to a vendor and said, "Look, you're going to be performing this mapping for me for my institution,
and then I own it.
I want to own it,
so I can use it with other
and
vendors
then they can use it
and save money."
The intent here is to be surgical and make sure that access to health information flows without major cost impediments, but not to get into the details of
negotiation,
value-added services. Yeah.
I'm just wondering where we've...
And if that hospital is smart, what they'll do is they'll try to move their code sets, their internal codes, closer and closer to open source standards or closer and closer to something that might...
So an open standard, yeah. Well, not open source standard, but an open standard.
Open standards,
yeah.
But the point is that I don't think we're going to be able to dictate through this how we want to have them do their business.
Yep. Okay.
The onus is on us to eliminate information blocking.
Yes.
And I'm wondering whether this is actually an area where it's not addressed right now, and it's an area that we could actually facilitate and assist.
How, looking at the world of open source, what level of this quote-unquote mapping can be more applied from open source?
But open source is a way of placing prior work into a more openly available way of consuming that without any additional charge.
There's still cost to implement. That's a misnomer.
There is an initial cost to create the...
To create it, but then also if you want to use it.
Sure.
It's like with Red Hat Linux.
Yeah.
But if we want to get there... To prevent information blocking in the fastest way. I mean, isn't that how the rest of the industry works to provide open sourcing?
In many cases,
on those mapping?
So for mappings, in many cases, ILM has solved this problem at a nationwide level by licensing and making available almost all of the relevant terminologies. The one example, the examples that exist are Medispan, FDB, GoldRx, et cetera, have a good amount of decision support that operate against historic reasons, not the RxNorm term, but their own GCN sequence numbers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. CPT is a classic example of something that does not fall within ILM licensing, and then the variety of uses of effectively proprietary codes. And so what this is trying to address is to the extent, so next paragraph, so I think we've got some good proposed modifications to this paragraph. Next paragraph is on IPR, again, intellectual property rights. Committee recommends that allowed fees for access, exchange, and use essential intellectual property rights be sent at a RAND basis. Such fees would not be reasonable if they materially discourage access, exchange, or use, or impede the development of competitive markets for value-added exchanges and use services. Recommends that access, exchange, and use essential IPR license grants be sufficient for actors to provide access and or deliver exchange and use services. So, as an example, here's the example. IPR grants for terminology sets that are access, exchange, or use essential should be sufficient to allow access, exchange, and use for permissible purposes. You can't restrict access to downstream actors through your IPR license grant.
So,
Logistically, you have earlier the term basic access and essential access. Are those the same, or are you contemplating different things for essential and basic access?
Yeah, so basic access is access effectively to the legal medical record and prospective pricing. Essential IPR is intellectual property rights that are reasonably required to expose the data and have it be interpreted and used. So an example of an essential IPR is the example of CPT codes, or in cases where, and fortunately in healthcare we don't have many of these, this is much more prevalent in consumer technology and the like, in cases where the standard has an associated IPR license, so a patent license that needs to be included.
Now, are all of these recommendations, clarifications that are going to the preamble?
Now, these are all recommendations for ONC to consider to make updates to the ex and preamble as appropriate.
Oh, so we're not getting
there's no regulatory text drafting in 1.2.
Okay, we'll want to make sure.
It was felt that that was extensive and
that
not necessary
out
there.
Are we making a recommendation just for them to take that recommendation and change the preamble or regulatory
text? We're letting ONC make that determination.
Yeah.
I think what they were asking us to do in our recommendation is to say that we're not specifying. Now, your format is much clearer than what our task force did. Because you actually show regulatory text.
Oh, I was channeling my inner Cynthia, who said, I want to see the markup.
Yeah.
Okay.
And honestly, this stuff, I don't think we are suitably skilled.
I agree. We tried and
failed.
Failed, exactly.
No, they're better suited to.
Yeah.
The other word was it was more straightforward.
Yeah.
This is actually quite
complicated. And I think that's the case in a lot of our recommendations from CMC.
Yeah.
That we're not trying to.
What we want to do is define the outcomes we're seeking to achieve. I must confess, I'm a little bit, and this is not just me, it's also the humble vessel by which other members of the work group wish to express themselves through me. The mapping one is potentially a thorn.
Yeah.
Because with the spirit of CURES, was looking to remove barriers to information sharing.
Yep.
If mappings are created, then why would they not be freely available?
Yeah, they would be freely. They would be basically freely available if I provide.
Freely being the opposite term,
right?
Not openly.
So here's the way I would put this, and I'm welcome. I this is just at this point we're discussing ways of addressing the text to potentially address this issue. Here's the way that I would put this. I would say a vendor has an obligation under basic access provisions to make the data usable. The easiest way to do that is through mapping to a standard, and the usual way for a provider or other systems integrator interact with that vendor is via the well-defined standards, or via, if there aren't standards, via whatever mechanism the vendor provisioned to enable that basic access. That's number one. So the mapping would be included because I could pull the data out of the EHR in the form, in a standards-based form. If you're asking for, well, you should also provide access to internal database terminology to external standard, with my software engineering hat on, I'd say, wouldn't it be better just to offer an API that provides access to all of the capability and not get into building brittle mappings into database structures that are going to change from version release to version release? And are you then putting yourself in the position of regulating basically version releases and database changes?
I think that's a different issue.
Okay.
I get where you're coming from. That I think the provision of open APIs using open standards, I think, is well litigated through. And we get I'm talking about where there is specific coding, which is not necessarily a standards base, and it's not necessarily a complete localization, although it could be.
Yeah.
And you and I know the ones. It's like where some you've got physicians in the primary care system, and when they see a patient who is, I'm just tired all the time, T-A-T-T, T-A-T-T, T-A-T-T. Well, but unfortunately, under recoding, that means tattoo.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's just a localization that we want to process the map of it.
So the obligation here is that if there is access exchange or use essential IPR, then that IPR needs to be licensed on a RAN basis. And if my local TATT code or my local HCTZ code, I can't tell you the myriad ways of spelling hydrochlorothiazide, is essential to interpreting the data that I've got, then it's got to be licensed on a RAN basis. That's at least the way this framework works.
I agree with you. I'm working out whether we want to try and push the boundary that little bit further.
Can I chime in? This is Stephen, and I no longer have the hand raising function, so I had to get in the car.
Yeah, we can't
but,
actually see the.
We can't see the hand raising function
anyway. We can't see what it's for, so we don't know if you
okay.
have the hand raised or not.
Very good. So I'll say maybe I did. I like where you're going, Andy. The idea that that mapping a vendor's custom codes, as opposed to a customer's custom codes. You know, a hospital system, a clinic, they may have custom codes. They're going to have to pay to get those mapped. But if a vendor has specialized codes, that the idea that the mapping of those two standard data sets should be kind of subsumed in the cost of the product as opposed to being a separate cost item sounds very appealing to me on the surface. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
That is, I believe, the proposal.
That is the proposal.
What kind of proposal?
Oh. No,
yeah.
I think that's the proposal.
Well, but when you use the term vendor custom codes, I'm trying to distinguish between what a customer does with their own coding versus what a vendor has done internally. What a vendor has done internally, they have an open API to that. That's out of the scope of what I'm talking about. I'm talking about where a customer has put their own codes in, because you speak up for vendors here because you see it all the time.
Sure. So I think the example, maybe to give an illustration, is that if a product included a specific set of, medications,
mm-hmm.
right, and used a proprietary code set to identify those 100 medications, then it would be responsibility of whoever's licensing that module to map those medications to something interoperable,
mm-hmm.
RxNorm, presumably. But I think the challenging part that Andy's getting at, if I understand, is that it might be possible for a healthcare organization to add their own medication records within this medication module.
Their own formulary entries, yeah.
Right. They
absolutely.
Said,
yeah.
You know, we have a custom mixture that we use to represent, you know, this particular cream, and we've added it to our medication record. And it wouldn't be possible for the vendor of the product to
mm-hmm.
know what the mixture they made at their organization, what should be represented in RxNorm. But there might be work involved to map those types of records, which might be used at just one site or potentially at multiple sites. And I think this gets to your should it be shared question to some sort of code.
Here's another example, labs.
Yeah.
Okay. The likelihood is that multiple providers are going to use the same lab.
Yeah.
It's highly likely that an app has some local coding.
Yeah.
Okay. And if provider A creates that map, everyone's got that joy of moment.
No, I think this actually addresses that issue.
Do you?
Yeah, I do. So this goes into the access exchange or use essential IPR RAN licensing.
I think it does address it is that I've got four vendors from four different provider organizations, used by four different provider organizations,
mm-hmm.
all using the same lab. Organization A with vendor one has created this map. Organization B with vendor two has to go and recreate that same map.
Wouldn't the lab make the map, though, and license it on RAN?
No. Sometimes, but sometimes not.
Let's do some more. Let's take these notes. So what I'm hearing, let me just state back what I'm hearing as the either expressed or implied consensus of the group to test to see whether this is true. I believe the task force believes that this is an appropriate way of striking the right balance between enabling access, exchange, and use, and not impeding the development of value-added services, and that the pricing mechanisms here are sufficient to ensure that information flows. I think there are additional examples that need to be put into this text to provide more color, and I believe that there's an issue relating to mappings for proprietary terminology that we may need a little more discussion of in a proposal for.
It's not an issue. Is there an opportunity mm-hmm. here? And if there is an opportunity, should we embrace it mm-hmm. or should we stay silent? I think
there's clarification that's required relative yep. to the intent, and then there's potentially an addition that we could contemplate relative to mappings of proprietary terminology to standard terminology that are effectively essential for basic access.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you had a point to make.
I did, but I think
it's in the middle of all this somewhere.
Yeah, we can move on.
Before we go to public comment, Arianne's taken us through, and we've discussed some pretty intricate details of how this could manifest itself. And has anybody else got anything they'd like to say before we go to public comment?
I just want to be formal because I expressed an implied consent. I just want to pause and make sure that I am expressing the intent of the work group appropriately. Hearing no objection.
I think the one thing that Andy said earlier was, is there a way we could have something more freely available
mm-hmm.
in the mapping, open source,
right.
freely
so
available,
that
so you
yeah.
efficiently, cost effectively, time wise, and
it's about reducing
money.
Provider
yeah,
burden.
That's right.
Pardon?
It's about reducing provider burden. And it's reducing provider burden. Maybe the thing will get it.
Maybe that's a.
Yeah, we'll talk about that as well. I think
yeah.
I think Sasha kind of sees where I'm coming from.
On the mapping question?
Yeah, but it's very different. It's not like there's one size fits all because there's not just one scenario.
I think it might be helpful to talk about some more scenarios. Some of the ones we've talked about today have been very helpful for me to understand the intent of
yeah.
the recommendations, and maybe some mapping scenarios would help us.
Yeah, that one's a good one. I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would be good.
Multiple providers using one lab with multiple systems.
Maybe that would be a good one to flesh out further in a subsequent conversation.
We need more time. Okay, let's go to public comment.
30 seconds.
Oh you remember what you were talking about.
No, but it's just
okay.
Another point. I like the idea of putting the application in the in front than the provider burden, but don't forget also that a lot of what we've done in the industry has been through innovation, and if we don't leave an opportunity for those to actually innovate, not just to make money, but just to be somewhat creative, we're going to
yep.
lose out. So think about that in the lens of where we're thinking about some of the giving the maps away, because who's the first vendor who's going to do it? I mean, they'll wait for the other vendors to do it.
Yeah. Everyone will wait then for nothing.
Everyone will wait for nothing,
yeah.
Exactly.
It's like who's
okay.
All right.
Public comment, please.
Operator, can you open the line for public comment?
Yes, thank you. If you'd like to make a public comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad, and a confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue.
Okay.
You may press star 2 if you'd like to remove your comment from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys.
Okay, is there anybody in the room or no? or on the phone who'd like to comment?
There are no comments at this time.
Okay, thank you. All right.
Okay. You got more to add?
I just think it's really, we had to think about real-world cases. I like Sasha's
yeah.
point. But we had to go through and play out some scenarios of where this is happening and not have a theoretical, not saying we've been theoretical all this time, but saying that we have to look at what the clinical leadership, clinical IT leadership in a hospital provider, how does the patient, when they see this information being presented, how do they benefit from having some of this exchange be done in this way? And then how do we move the entire industry in a way that says that we're not going to use proprietary codes as a way of information blocking, but there are a whole host of folks who use proprietary codes to add value to their services, and maybe that mapping is what we focus on.
Yep.
But I just want to be careful we don't end up stifling innovation in the process of trying to make
it. And that's a good point. I think we're using the term mapping to cover multiple scenarios.
Yeah.
We probably need to distill that out into some real-world ones.
Yeah.
So we're clear what we're talking about. I need to think through the scope of basic access as we've got it right now, just for my own contribution to the group.
It might be helpful, I think, Arian, your clarification on those, to define each of those in the recommendations.
Mm-hmm.
I think basic access is defined in the 4th, 5th recommendation, but I don't know that essential access is.
Essential access is defined.
Is that TF recommends that OSC distinguish between IPR that are essential to access, exchange, or use the basic facts about the basic.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Thank you.
I actually think, Arian, whilst we've talked through many of the sentiments herein, probably need to do a bit of a restructuring.
Yeah, yeah.
I think we probably need to define this is the outcome we're seeking to achieve.
Yep.
And these are our recommendations to get there.
That's right.
And we probably have a good idea about what's going on.
That's exactly right. And I think it's more helpful to give, in this, with something as knotty and difficult as this, it is more helpful to give ONC a clear policy direction and then some examples for how to solve that policy direction. But they may want to take the policy direction. Obviously,
we
think
you
can get
there, but you need to work.
Yeah, exactly.
And we're not going to draft it.
And we're not going to draft it for you. Sorry.
To Anil's point, you want to make sure that we're not burdening with protectionism.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
With the today's existing vendors and system integrators speaking in the room. But I do think it is really important to move towards opening it up that in whatever way, cost effectively, open source, open up the pipes, let the tech innovators come into this field as well, and let us all compete to provide for them.
I agree with you. And we also need to not forget that the term mapping, you automatically jump to think it's a one-to-one thing. It's just completely not. Mapping is horrendously complicated. It has massive clinical governance burdens around it, and it's many-to-one, one-to-many, many-to-many. Especially when you're dealing with something as granular as SNOMED versus something as coarse as ICD, etc. And those maps exist.
By the way, I just want to, because I did pull up designated record set. The definition of designated record set under HIPAA, designated record set means, one, a group of records maintained by or for a corporate entity, that is subpart I, the medical records and billing records about individuals maintained for or by a covered entity covered healthcare provider. So the one piece this does not include is the prospective price, and I think we need to make sure that we're adding to that the prospective price.
We do have a definition of EHI, don't we?
Yeah.
So EHI consumes designated record set by inclusion.
Right.
So I think as long as this is feeding back to EHI.
Although I think, actually, subpart 2 is enrollment, payment, claims adjudication, and case or medical management record systems maintained for or by a health plan. And by the way, have you ever seen a health plan actually give the enrollment, payment, claims adjudication, and case or medical records management system access to patients? I'd love to see that.
Arian, on that point, it was raised yesterday with Alex's testimony around the definition of a plan versus a payer.
Yeah.
Which that would fall firmly into the commercial plan versus the...
Well, health plans are covered entities under HIPAA. Commercial health plans are covered entities under HIPAA.
But that's what we mean by that term,
right.
Not a payer, a plan.
In the definition designated record set, subpart III, it's an or, it's not an and, is or, used in whole or in part by or for the covered entity to make decisions about individuals. So I actually believe the prospective pricing information, the charge master, for example, is used to make decisions about individuals and falls within that definition. But I don't know that ONC...
So by, they might not have the same interpretation of that. Okay. Is there any public comments on the line?
Operator?
No comments at this time.
So we have to break up the party because there's another meeting coming in here right now at 11. So we'll have to get back to this tomorrow.
We are on top of the hour. Task Force, thank you very much. Members of the public, thank you very much for listening in. See you all next time.
I think we made some significant
Thank you. Great, great meeting.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We have, because we cranked through something which was really hoary before because it was unhelpfully worded, and now it's more helpfully worded but very hoary.
Yeah, exactly.
I like combining the two sections into one.
Yeah,
are
you saying that
much
that
more
record
clear?
Site is the same thing as the legal medical record? I don't know.
What's that, Sasha?
Yes.
Combining the two different sections on licensing and pricing into one section.